I believe I wore more chains than any slave you can think of.
Since the pandemic began, abolitionists have intensified their urgent demands to release people held in jails, prisons, and immigration detention facilities.
A private prison corporation has set up shop that has dehumanized and mistreated thousands, hundreds of thousands of our undocumented sisters and brothers.
Immigration detention prisons have been identified as major super spreader locations.
That's why people call them the death camps, because they do mean for people to die on the inside. It's murder by prison.
Dequi Kioni Siddiqui of the Jericho Movement, supporting political prisoners and prisoners of war. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy. I am your host, Nana Chupti. Government criminalizes resistance while denying the existence of hundreds of political prisoners and prisoners of war. Many have languished for decades in some of the most unhealthy, repressive, and torturous conditions anywhere in the world. The pandemic has created even greater urgency to free them now. Pacificus Ken Yale spoke with Dequi Kioni Siddiqui, an activist with the Jericho Movement, which supports U.S.-held political prisoners and prisoners of war. She's also a teacher, an author, and a radio host at WBAI in New York. Dequi is married to Sekou Odinga, who was imprisoned for over 33 years for being a fighter for the Black Liberation Movement.
Let's start by clarifying our language a little bit. What do you mean when you refer to somebody as a political prisoner, and how is that different from someone you'd call a prisoner of war?
When we talk about political prisoners, we're talking about people who were actively engaged in ways that challenged this capitalist system, that challenged the country. So they're in prison because of their beliefs, because of their writings, because of their actions, because of their associations and or membership in organizations. And when we say prisoner of war, those are the individuals that were actively engaged in the military formation, defending and struggling against this system.
How do you make the case for the right of oppressed peoples to engage in more militant forms of struggle?
Well, one is that the oppressor doesn't have the right to tell people how they should defend themselves or fight for their freedom. And it's also written not only in the Declaration of Independence, but international law. People have a right to fight for their freedom. And as African people in particular, there was a war declared on people when we were kidnapped in 1619. There was a war declared on indigenous people when they came here in 1492. And people have been struggling for the right to their land, the right to their culture, the right to their language, the right to their self-determination, the right to their liberation, their right to live. And so people have been engaged in that war in different manifestations across the centuries. The biggest challenge that we have is that the state, the corporate media, the history books have so demonized and criminalized resistance. Harriet Tubman was criminalized in her lifetime. Had she been caught and captured, she would have been a political prisoner until they hung her. And so anyone who has fought Nat Turner, he was a political prisoner of war until when he was captured and when they assassinated him because of his actions in the war for liberation. Right now, we have about 10 members of the Black Panther Party who remain in prison. But there are white anti-imperialist political prisoners. There are political prisoners from the American Indian Indigenous Movement. There are Puerto Rican political prisoners because oppressed people fight. Oppressed people resist. They're all over this country. Veronica Bowers is doing federal time. Dr. Matulu Shakur is doing federal time. And then there are people who are doing state time, like Sundiata Okoli, who was on that turnpike with Asada Shakur that May 2nd day, as well as with Zayd Shakur, who ended up being murdered. Asada was captured that day. Sundiata escaped for a little while, but then he was captured.
I wish I could share all the love that's in my heart. Keep us apart. I wish you could know what it means to be me. Then you'd see and agree that every man should be free.
And so while this government refuses to acknowledge verbally the existence of political prisoners, they get particular kind of treatment singled out for them, like taking their mail, taking their merchandise, tossing their cells, all kinds of ways. And they're sent to the worst facilities. Sekou did 19 years in solitary confinement. Russell Maroon Schultz, who is in Pennsylvania, did like 20 years in solitary confinement. They want to keep people who do that kind of organizing and have those kinds of connections to people. They want to keep them separate. So like, it's so important for people to let the prison know that people that are in there have people outside on the outside who care about them and are concerned. So it's like, it's eyes on them without necessarily having your physical eyes on them. But it's like, we know that our people are there and we're going to be checking in to see how they're doing.
Wow. So on top of all of that, we had the pandemic. I'm wondering in what ways the conditions may be even worse for political prisoners and prisoners of war in terms of the pandemic.
It's definitely worse. First of all, we have lost so many political prisoners due to medical neglect. Russell Maroon Schultz has gotten COVID. Sundiata has gotten COVID. Matulu has gotten COVID. Kamal Siddiqui has so many health issues because he has an ulcer on his leg that they have refused to treat. And that is something that's been going on for years. And we've had to have different campaigns just to have him have a doctor look at it. Ed Poindexter just had heart bypass surgery about a year ago, maybe a year and a half ago. So all of these brothers, they have like severe health issues, not only because they're aging, but because of like 30, 40 years of prison medical neglect, the lack of quality food, vegetables. So these brothers are elders now. They're in their 70s and 80s. So in addition to the regular health issues that come with being 70 years old, then you have the prison medical neglect. And now you have COVID. So I spoke to one of the brothers. He's in Butner, North Carolina. And he said it is raging. COVID is raging through that facility. Every couple of days, they get to come out for an hour to use the phone because they're in a state of lockdown. That's their way of treating it. Like here in New York State, prisoners are made to make the hand sanitizer, but they can't use it, right? That's why people call them the death camps, because they do mean for people to die on the inside. It's murder by prison.
I wish I could give all I'm longing to give. I wish I could live like I'm longing to live. I wish I could do all the things that I can do, though I'm way overdue. I'd be stuck.
I'm wondering what you're thinking about the way the state has moved in the past year against political activists in order to justify increased state surveillance, brutality, and repression. So, for example, the attempt to divide the Black Lives Matter protesters as the good, peaceful protesters versus the bad, militant protesters.
I don't know that I see it any differently than what they've always done. It's just the media is so much more pronounced in the ways that they control the narrative, right? It's not just how they present the activists of Black Lives Matter. It's how they just present Black and Indigenous folks in every way, in every media conglomerate. There is a demonization that takes place around Black folks. And so it makes it harder for us to be in control of the narrative to say, wait a minute, we have a right to struggle. How does any person in this United States and these politicians and historians and all of these people talk about it's so important to be peaceful protesters? Ain't nothing peaceful about poverty. Ain't nothing peaceful about police terror and murder. Ain't nothing peaceful about homelessness. Ain't nothing peaceful about people's children being miseducated. So by the time they graduate high school, they can't even fill out a job application or write a college essay. Black folks don't get peace from the cradle to the grave, but they want them to protest peacefully. People have to do however they feel that they need to express themselves. But I think it's a major contradiction to demonize people when they are outraged, because how long have people been saying, you got your foot on my neck and I want it off? So we whisper it, we write songs, we do all the ways. And then when you still don't get it, then I'm just fed up. I'm fed up and I can't take it no more, right? And then you want me to be peaceful in the face of me never having any peace in my life. But we know they come for you in the morning, they're coming for me at night. Mass incarceration started with the war on Black liberation, right? When they were locking up and imprisoning the radicals and revolutionaries of the 1960s. Once they got that out the way, then they came after the Black men, right? With the so-called war on drugs. Then it was Black women. Then it was Black children. Then it was the so-called war on terror, and it was Muslims and Arabs. Then it's the war on immigration, and it's people who are coming to land that is really theirs already, right?
Well, I wish I could be like a bird in the sky. How sweet it would be if I
Talk some more about the kinds of activism that's being done to support political prisoners and prisoners of war. Who are the organizations? And then what are some of the key demands of these organizations?
Some people have individual defense committees, which is made up of, in some cases, family members like Imam Jamil Alameen. Mumia Abu-Jamal has a defense committee. Russell Maroon Schultz has his family and a committee. There's RAP, Release Aging People from Prison. The Movement for Black Lives has been picking up the mantle of learning about and supporting political prisoners. The problem is not everybody has a defense committee. So that's where the Jericho Movement and Northeast Political Prisoner Movement comes in, because they don't support any one particular political prisoner. They are, you know, in support of advocating for the release. So whether it's compassionate release, whether it's medical, whether it's elder clemency, there are different ways that people are advocating through the courts or through pressure on politicians to release people.
And is there a particular source or website you would suggest for people who want to get more involved in activism or stay informed around what's happening with political prisoners?
TheJerichoMovement.com. I think that one of the things that you mentioned is important for people to remember. Any one of us at any given time can be a political prisoner. Because once you begin to say, I'm not going to take this oppression anymore and I have a right to fight back, then that means that you can become a target. It's so important that we know that with these individuals that we fight on behalf of, they stood up for the future. And so they deserve for us to stand up for them. Everyone who has ever eaten breakfast in school or had their children eat breakfast in school, every person that has ever visited a free or sliding scale health clinic, gotten tested for sickle cell anemia, went to a food pantry, a clothing drive, like all of those things were the survival programs of the Black Panther Party that made them a target of J. Edgar Hoover's COINTELPRO program, in which they were imprisoned, they were criminalized, they were assassinated, they were driven into exile. But everybody has access. They now call them social programs. Well, that is owed to some of those people that are in prison today. That's owed to some of them who crossed over to the other side and died while behind the wall, as well as those who were released, like my husband, who came home in 2014. So we stand on the shoulders of those who are living, in addition to standing on the shoulders of those who have become ancestors. It's good to remember the ancestors and call their names, but we have living freedom fighters. So it is important for all of us to know that we must participate in different ways in struggle. Everybody's not going to do the same thing, but everybody can do something.
I already know.
That was Dequi Kioni Siddiqui of the Jericho Movement in conversation with Pacifica's Ken Yale, with music by Nina Simone. Listen to the full interview or learn more about supporting political prisoners and prisoners of war by clicking on the link for this program, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.
Individual, you know, with a beautiful soul, very considerate, a black person in the United States of America, and from the island, and pronoun her.
Take a look at these hands. Immigration detention prisons have been identified as major super spreader locations. According to a recent report from Detention Watch, over 230,000 COVID-19 infections in the United States are directly related to immigration detention prisons. Immigrants caged in detention have long reported human rights and medical abuses, including ICE's failure to provide basic PPE, such as soap and masks, and ICE's failure to allow detained people to observe social distancing rules. Zsa is a black trans woman recently released after a near decade in immigration detention.
I got picked up by ICE August 18th of 2012, and I never got out until October 26th of 2020. So it was practically 8 years from detention center to detention center. I usually refer to it as prison because you're still housed with, you know, murderers, you name it. Whatever the charges are, you're housed with the very same people. You're not treated any differently. So the word detention is just a nice way of saying it because it suits the public needs and the basis of their ignorance as to actually what transpires behind those walls.
I think when people hear detention, they think it's like school detention. Do you know what I'm saying? Like it's this space where you are almost like in a dorm being held until they decide what they're doing with your immigration case. What would you want people to know? Because it's a mystery to most people. What would you want people to know about the conditions in ICE detention, especially during this COVID pandemic?
That the condition is dismal. It's just the same procedures, the same everything as it is for a rapist, a murderer. The word detention, as I mentioned earlier, is just a fancy word to pull the wool over the eyes of the general public, not knowing what is actually going on behind those walls. And so, like he says, I've been housed with murderers from detention centers to detention centers in different states, all hours of the morning, all hours of the night, chained up. I believe I wore more chains than any slave you can think of, because you're shackled in every faculties and you just be moving unknowingly. And so it is very grave. It's not as it seems, and one has to take into consideration. It's the same of everything, for just it's one size fits all.
Zaza, you've described the conditions of detention and really made it clear how they are equal to the conditions of prison. And, you know, you're including being there with people who are imprisoned on criminal sanctions. Tell us about what it's like for someone who is trans, as you are. What was that experience in detention?
It's devastating. It's immoral. It's if one can just imagine what it's like being in the streets and the way trans is treated in the streets, LGBTQ members in particular, picture what it would be like being in a detention center when you're housed with men, when with knowledge of your sexuality or your identity, the guards, the inmates, the nurses, the doctors, the wardens. It's degrading. It's very degrading. You have to be on your P's and Q's at all times. The advances unwanted. It's just the immoralities that one face being in the system as a transgender.
And so, I mean, for most folks, and it's so sad to say, Zaza, I hate to have to say it, but for most folks, they don't really know what it's like to be trans in the street. When you talk about, for example, the guards or even the medical staff, what kinds of things were you subjected to?
You're subjected to name calling. You're subjected to being laughed at. You've been subjected to being ridiculed. You're always the last to everything. Your pronouns doesn't really make much of a difference. They'll correct you in an instance. Even, for example, I was coming from medical. We was on our way back from medical, me and this one girl, her name is Shakira. And we had to stop because the male population was coming, so we had to step to the side. And so the guard was like, "Hey, man, you need to go over here." And she was like, "That's not my name. You have to address me as ma'am or she or whatever the case may be." And he was like, "Ha, ha, 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 ha. Okay, man."
Oh, gosh.
And so I had to step in and said, "You're being real disrespectful." She specifically told you not to address her as a guy. And then you went further to really being, you know, to degradations. Yeah, and I had to step in and let him know that it's not that kind of party.
That's just ridiculous. It's outrageous. You know, I can't imagine that you were subjected to that and worse. I know. Over that entire time period that you were incarcerated, basically, by ICE. When we look at some of the studies and statistics that have come out that many folks who are transgender, who are in ICE detention, are also held in solitary confinement for part of their time that they are incarcerated. Did you have to experience that as well?
Yeah, I spent 7 months or a little over 7 months in solitary confinement.
Goodness. Solitary confinement is supposed to be a punishment. So what was the reason given for why you were in solitary confinement?
Well, I am, like it says, I'm black. African features in general. And so the ones that I was housed with, they was pretty much Hispanics. They have their weaves and stuff, you know, as long as they wanted it to. And so that gave them an edge, you know, in terms of their features. And so when they came at me there, and then I'm not sure if you're known that they have their little prejudices, even if you're from the same country as they do. And so that was a problem in and of itself, and that's what led to me being taken out of the general population and placed in isolation.
So you're placed in isolation because of other people's bigotry, because of other people's anti-blackness and racism.
Exactly, not having the features like the Jennifer Lopez features or the Shakira, the singer I'm talking about, features, or the Ariana Grande features, which they really pull it. It was easier for them to pull it off,
right,
as opposed to a person that is just generally a black person. So the color was one instance, and then you're not portraying that you can try hard enough to get that Jennifer Lopez look.
Right. So using this other standard of, for lack of better expression, femininity. And basically,
exactly,
because of your, because even, you know, it's like black women, cis or trans, are viewed as not feminine enough in this society. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I would.
And so how did you get out of, as what you describe, that hell? How did you get out of that situation?
First, I'm always conscious of my surrounding. I bend my mind and learning. And I also have to get an attorney involved. And I refuse to bend because now it comes down to me choosing between going back to that particular general population, which is actually a trans unit, which is exclusively for trans. I know they wanted to move me from the trans unit and brought me to the general populations, which would subject me to harassment, beaten. You never know what the result is going to be. And that is where ICE in particular wanted to place me. And then based on my refusal to go there, because they wanted me to consent to it. In terms, when I said consent, I mean they wanted me to put it in writing that it was my desire, and then signed off on it. And it says, no, you can take me there if you want to, but I am not consenting to any of this. I am not putting it in writing. I am not signing anything. And so if you're ready to take me there right now, I will go. So I knew the reason they wanted me to sign off it because it's a liability.
Right.
And I guess race plays a big part of it.
That, and you know, your spirit, your indomitable spirit is something that I definitely connect with, and I can so feel it, even as you're speaking with me today. What kept you going? Like, how did you, through all of this, still have the wherewithal to fight and to push back and to resist and to stand up for yourself? What kept you going?
Understanding that one should never have to be afraid of what they are or who they are. Understanding that there's a will, and the will have to be a will to live. Feeling out of pain, out of transgender's pain, seeing what they've been through, because there's not a lot of us that are so strong as in personality. There's not a lot of us that bend our mind to learning. And so when I educate myself and the things that I knew, and when they spoke, I was able to speak back. I was able to make the correction when necessary. I had to let them know I'm not here to tamely surrender. I knew who I am, the words, and that you're no better person than I am, irrespective of what you might think or your belief in general. But you have to be strong in order to survive. You're in a room full of vultures.
Mm.
And therefore, you have to have a will to live. You have to have a will to survive. You have to know who you are. But most importantly, I was ready to die for what I believe in.
Wow. Thank you so very much, Zaza. I really appreciate you speaking with us and sharing this information. As I said, I was so impressed with your determination, with the way that you just made people want to support you. You know, the love that I saw other people have for you. Often you can tell a lot about a person by who loves them. And, you know, to see all of that love that was being shown for you, let me know that, hey, there's a lot going on here, a lot more than I may even realize. And so I wanted to be able to take this deeper dive with you. And I really appreciate that. How can people who are listening to this interview, how can they support not just you, but other trans folks who are incarcerated, whether it be in ICE detention or whether it be in prisons or jails? What should people be doing?
One of the first things you have to do is to educate yourself and to not listen to the rhetoric that the politicians are the bigots want you to believe. And the word detention, it's a fancy word. It's imprisonment. It is prison camps, camps after camp. But one of the things that I've learned from Nelson Mandela, he said, and I quote, that you never knew a nation until one has been inside of its prisons. One never truly knows a nation until you've been inside of its prison. And that was one of the things that I used to get through the turmoil. So one first have to educate themselves. One have to be sincere and has empathy for others. One must respect a person's identity. One must respect a person's beliefs. No one have the right to try to take away from you, especially to strip you of your dignity. And once you can feel for other people by starting looking at yourself, thinking of how would you feel if that were you, your children, your brothers, your sisters. Know that we are all one people. And once you started to look in yourself and to find empathy, to sympathize with others, to respect others, to respect diversity, then there's nothing we can do. Nothing we can't do together, because together we stand.
That was Zaza, formerly detained advocate of the human rights of Black trans people. Listen to the full interview or learn more about supporting Black LGBTQAI plus migrants by clicking on the link for this program at covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.
Destroyed.
is COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Nana Jumphy. Since the pandemic began, abolitionists have intensified their urgent demands to release people held in jails, prisons, and immigration detention facilities. One of the most successful efforts has been the work of NYC COVID Bailout. This collective of Black organizers, allies, and movement attorneys is bailing out and supporting people released from the infamous Rikers Island Jail in New York. Brittany Williams, a Black community organizer and dancer, leads support services with BAJI, the Black Alliance for Just Immigration.
What is New York City COVID Bailout and what prompted its formation?
We were really concerned about the safety and well-being of people in New York City jails, particularly at that time. New York City had the highest COVID rate in the country, in the jails, right? And so the people incarcerated were burying the dead from the hospitals, right? Mm-hmm. And so what's sitting within you now when you ask that question? It was because of survival, because our community members were in those jails. And we were trying to do everything we could do to not only just bail them out, because we know most of these people may be homeless, or most of these people may be harassed by the NYPD and a cycle of violence going in and out of jail. So how I ended up being looped in with COVID Bailout is because I've done mass bailout, which happened a couple of years before, which we not only bailed people out of jail, but we also started supporting them in a real way. And so I was brought on to think about, hey, how can we support our community members coming home? If they have been exposed to COVID, can we offer them 2 weeks stay to quarantine? Can we figure out ways for community members if they have their houses? Because during that moment, many people had left New York City, so it was a lot of empty apartments available. So we were, you know, calling on community members. Can some of the people that were being bailed out can live in your home for a couple of months until you come back home? This is why I was called on to think about this and plan this with community members that were living in NYCHA. People who we were bailing out was, you know, coming in to support us. So, yeah, that's a little bit about COVID Bailout.
It's such a really important effort that you've engaged in. It takes the words and the thoughts, you know, that so many people have, the policy talk that so many people engage in, and really just made it real. And, you know, I'm thinking about stories that I heard of folks when there wasn't that support services coming out of Rikers and then immediately getting arrested. Can you talk a little bit about that, like the need to assist on that level?
What we realized was we started bailing people out. And what we realized was the NYPD and the government was doing everything in its power to lock people back up, right? And so we would bail people out and the NYPD will hold them for false charges or pick them up at the bus stop. So we started having to camp out at Rikers Island when they get off the bus to pick them up, because what the state was doing was trying to keep as many people in jail as possible. And so, like, they continue to have these sweeps in the middle of the night, forcing people either into shelters, into jails. And what we found out was some people who we bailed out, is there's no difference at this point between the shelters and the jails. It's not safe. And so we've been working really, really hard to find placement, housing placement, working with community members, healers, everyone who feel like they had a skill and want to use it in this moment. We've been working with them. And most of these people have been Black and brown people on our end.
That's excellent. And that's also very important, because we know, we've seen how sometimes when Black and brown folks are not at the leadership positions, not the ones that are being followed in these efforts, how it just turns into a disaster. And so, you know, I really want to thank you for the work that you have been doing and the ways in which you have been supporting the community, talking about the police, law enforcement, the ways that they have insisted that jails are one of the ways to address issues that should be clearly addressed in other ways. Connect the work for us between New York City COVID bailout plus the support services that you've been providing with the assistance of Black Alliance for Just Immigration and abolition, the work for abolition in New York City and beyond.
The work that we're doing in New York City is vital to abolition. There is this scholar named Jerome Dent, and he said something. And one thing that sticks with me is, what happens when the imagination is not enough? What happens to the Black body that experiences violence? State sanctioned violence is what I'm thinking about. What happens when the imagination is not enough? And so I think the work that we're doing in New York City, when the city council, the mayor, still in the middle of a pandemic, is advocating to build 4 new jails at the cost of $11 billion plus, and not giving people money for rent.
Mm-hmm.
Before the pandemic, there were 66,000 plus people who were homeless. That number has increased during this pandemic. They're still homeless. In the middle of the uprisings with George Floyd, they would not, the city council would not, and I keep saying this because it's sitting in my heart, I believe we don't need police, period. They would not answer calls to defund or abolish the police or anything in New York City. So when we talk about abolition and talking about what does a world look like with jails and prisons, we also have to face violence. We also have to face, how do we deal with harm? How do we deal with many different cultures of violence that we live in and generationally have impacted us, right? And that leads me to many answers, but the one is, I have a role in my community to show up. I may not be perfect. This role is on a spectrum, but this work that we're doing is a part of a long legacy and lineage that, like, you know, like, I don't get to claim, but I'm honored and I'm blessed to do this work and stand to do this work with my ancestors, but also for future generations forward. So when we're talking about abolition, no one is going to come save us. This is our work, to show up for our people and figure it out. Regardless if those jails are built or not, we need to make sure we can convene and have conversations with ourselves and practice a world without jails and prisons on a daily basis. It's not just about the imagination. It's about the doing and figuring it out, failing, experimenting, and building collectively.
That was Brittany Williams, Support Services Coordinator with BAJI and New York City COVID Bailout. Click on covidtaskforce.pacifica.org to hear the full interview or learn more about efforts to support people imprisoned at Rikers Island.
You have the emergence in human society of this thing that's called the state. What is the state? The state is this organized bureaucracy. It is the police department. It is the army, the navy. It is the prison system, the courts, and what have you. This is the state. It is a repressive organization. But the state, and you, well, you know, you've got to have the police, because if there were no police, look at what you'd be doing to yourselves. You'd be killing each other if there were no police. But the reality is, the police become necessary in human society. Only at that juncture in human society, where it is split between those who have and those who ain't got.
I throw a Molotov cocktail at the precinct. You know how we think. Organize the hood under our chain banners. Red, black, and green instead of gang bandanas. FBI spying on us through the radio antennas. And I'm hitting cameras in the streetlight watching society. With no respect for the people's right to privacy. I take a slug for the cause like Huey P. While all you fake niggas try to copy.
copy Master P. I wanna be free to live, able to have what I need to live. Bring the power back to the street where the people live. We sick of working for crumbs and filling up the prisons, dying over money and relying on religion for help.
Is one of the dirty, dark secrets of San Francisco. This is a story about race, a story about class, and a story about privilege. This is a story about a for-profit prison out of the state of Florida that has dehumanized, mistreated, and degraded numerous citizens and numerous undocumented immigrants throughout their detention centers. This is a story about GEO Group. This also is a story about failures in our criminal justice system.
Keith Malik Washington is the new editor of the San Francisco Bay View. This iconic Black newspaper is a communications hub for prison activism and a leading national voice for Black liberation.
Approximately in about January 8th, there was a COVID outbreak at 111 Taylor Street in the Tenderloin.
On January 9th, 2021, Washington contacted a reporter about a COVID-19 outbreak at the Taylor Street Center, a transitional prison facility where he is currently housed in San Francisco. The facility is operated by the GEO Group, a for-profit prison corporation on behalf of the Federal Bureau of Prisons. Censorship and retaliation against Malik Washington began the next day.
First, I was told that I could not attend a press conference that I helped organize, a press conference that shed light on racism and discrimination within the San Francisco health service system. Then my phone was taken away from me. Then I was told that I could not speak to members of the media or my fellow colleagues, a gag order. And I was told that if I deviated in any way, I would be returned to prison. There are people that have had the opportunity to release to their homes during this COVID crisis. There was only difference between me and them was my class and my skin color. Many of you might know that the former president allowed many of his friends and many of his colleagues to go to home confinement. These people, Paul Manafort, Michael Cohen, Roger Stone, and many, many others, there's a difference between me and them. And I think that you all can figure it out. But the point that I'm making is that President Joe Biden just recently stated an executive directive that said in clear language that the U.S. Department of Justice would not no longer do business with private prison corporations. The words that President Biden used were powerful. President Joe Biden has said that he wants racial equity. Well, his words have to be coupled with actions. So I'm calling on Joe Biden. I'm calling on Susan Rice. I'm calling on our Vice President Kamala Harris to get involved right now and to put their hands on this situation. The free speech violations that are going on must be addressed immediately. Many in the LGBTQ community are mortified that the location of this historic cafeteria is actually a place where a private prison corporation has set up shop, a private prison corporation that has degraded, dehumanized, and mistreated thousands, hundreds of thousands of our undocumented sisters and brothers. And now, in the middle of San Francisco, they have enacted a scheme with the Federal Bureau of Prisons to violate not just my First Amendment rights, but the First Amendment rights of this amazing national Black newspaper that has been in this community for 45 years. We are going up against a multi-billion dollar company. Our little tiny newspaper, founded 45 years ago, and then for the past 30 years, Dr. Willie Ratcliffe and Sister Mary Ratcliffe have kept this mighty national black newspaper afloat. This is about freedom of the press. This is about constitutional rights. And this is about getting GEO Group out of San Francisco. I'm going to allow my attorney, Richard Tan, to talk about some of the legal issues that we are actually facing.
It's literally life-saving information for members of the community. It's our belief that Mr. Washington, along with the San Francisco Bayview, did the right thing in bringing this information to the attention of the public, and that it was wrong to retaliate against them. And that's the heart of what this lawsuit is about. I think that most people in San Francisco and the Bay Area would be shocked to discover that there's a private prison facility operated by the federal government in the middle of the Tenderloin that they walk past every day. Where is the information from the GEO Group or BOP explaining how many cases there currently are in the facility, what measures are being done to screen the residents of the facility as well as staff? Are there cases of transmission among the staff or are only residents infected? You know, is PPE being distributed and what kind of testing is being done? These are all questions that the people of the Bay Area and San Francisco are entitled to know. Now, with that, I'm going to turn the conference over to Mary Ratcliffe, who's the co-founder of the San Francisco Bayview.
This is retaliation against years of work. 25 years ago, we began hearing from prisoners. We were a black newspaper. They thought maybe these folks would be interested in what we have to say about what's going on in prison. They kept writing. A few years ago, over a decade ago, they began using the paper to collaborate on remedies. How can we fix this? How can we fix this very badly broken criminal justice system? They've been doing that ever since. The result is what you hear and see in the major media every day. You hear about prisons now. You didn't used to hear about them. That is what BOP and GEO Group is so angry about. So they are taking out their venom on him. They're taking out their venom on us. And we're not going to stand for it. And we believe that there are a lot of people who will think kindly of us for having the courage to bring these issues to the fore for many years and for many years to come.
We just heard from San Francisco Bayview publisher Mary Ratcliffe, editor Keith Malik Washington, and attorney Richard Tan. Go to sfbayview.com for more on how to defend the rights of prisoners and journalists and support the Black Liberation Movement.
You know they got me trapped in this prison of seclusion. Happiness living on the streets is a delusion. Even a smooth criminal one day must get caught. Shot up or shot down with the bullet that he bought. 9mm kicking, thinking about what the streets do to me. Cause they never taught peace in the black community. All we know is violence, do the job in silence. Walk the city streets like a rat pack of tyrants. Too many brothers, daily headed for the big pen. It's coming out worse off than when they went in. Over the years I've done a lot of growing up. Get drunk, throwing up, cuffed up. Then I said I had enough. There must be another route, way out to money and fame. I changed my name, played a different game. Tired of being trapped in this vicious cycle. If one more cop harasses me, I just might go psycho. And when I get him, I hit him with a bum rush. Only a lunatic would like to see a skull crush. Yo, if you're smart, you really let me go cheap. But keep me cooped up in this ghetto and catch the Uzi. They got me trapped.
Uh-huh, they can't keep the black man down.
They got me trapped.
Nah, they can't keep the black man down.
Trapped.
Uh-huh, they can't keep the black man down.
Trapped.
Nah, they can't keep the black man down.
They got me trapped.
This concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from the Pacifica Radio Network and its affiliate stations across the U.S. We heard music by Nina Simone, Dead Prez, Angelique Kidjo, Tupac, and Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings. Today's show was produced by Nana Jumfy, Polina Vasiliev, and Ken Yale. The show's executive producers are Akua Holt, Polina Vasiliev, and Steve Zeltzer. I've been your host, Nana Jumfy. You can find all previous episodes on our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Thanks for listening.